express fiduciary obligation?
Mr. Carlin? Your Honor, I think we've proven an express fiduciary obligation set forth in the terms of the provider agreement. And the testimony here today is that there is no review prior to these payments. Providers like Dr. Malti caused these payments to be made to themselves, and there's only a review afterwards. The provider agreement in paragraphs 10 and 13 set forth express provisions by which the providers assume responsibility to bill correctly, and if they bill incorrectly, to notify the department of that incorrect billing and to repay the account for and repay the money. And those are express terms setting forth a fiduciary duty.
Where's the trust race in this fiduciary relationship?
Yes, it exists because the providers can transfer money from the state treasury without any prior review. It's not an arm's-length transaction.
No. You're not following my question. Eighth Circuit law is pretty clear that we have to have an express trust, and that as part of that express trust, there has to be a race, the pool of money that's subject to the trust. Where's the race under the agreement?
It's in paragraph 13. It set forth the payments the provider receives for medical assistance program in error or in excess of the amount properly due.
Okay, so he has an obligation to pay them back.
Yes, that's the rust in it.
Is there any limitation in that agreement on his ability to use those proceeds pending the audit and the demand for payment?
There is none, but he does so at his own risk.
Yes, but that's not a trust.
I believe it is.
Okay, any further argument? Okay. There are basically three items that were brought before the court by the complaint. The first is an allegation under 523A2A that the debt is non-dischargeable as being money obtained by false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud. To prevail under Section 523A2A, a creditor has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the debtor made a false representation of fact. I'm not sure what the false representation of fact here is. Obviously, he misbilled. I understand that, and that's in fact what the administrative law judge appears to have concluded, that he misbilled for these items. I suppose the argument could be made that he was making a representation that he was rendering treatment rather than diagnostic. So we'll accept that as the false representation of fact. There must also be a showing that the debtor knew the statement was false at the time the debtor made it. There's been no showing of what the debtor knew or did not know at the time that statement was made. There's been no showing the debtor knew that he was using the improper billing code. There also has to be a showing that the debtor made the representation with the intent and purpose of deceiving the creditor. Again, there's been no showing of what debtor's intent was. The record is he misbilled, and ALJ found that, and I accept that as I'm bound to do, but there's nothing in the record that I believe demonstrates and certainly doesn't demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence that debtor made the representation with any particular intent. I noted in the ALJ findings that the department specifically did not allege fraud before the ALJ. Had the department alleged fraud and had the ALJ found fraud, we might be in a different posture this morning. But since the department did not allege fraud, there's nothing in that decision that would support my finding of fraud. The last two elements, just to get the nail flush with the board, is that the creditor justifiably relied upon the representation. At first, I was concerned that the debtor or the creditor didn't even look at the documents, so how could they be said to rely on them? But it's pretty clear, based upon the testimony I heard this afternoon, that there is a justification for the way they do business. They are flooded with these, and they cannot review everyone. And so they are relying upon the physicians and other providers to represent the truth. And so I find that that reliance was justifiable. The fifth and final finding is that the creditor sustained financial injury as a proximate result of the making of the representation. and regardless of what amount is attributable to Dakota Psychological and what amount is attributable to debtor, it's clear to me that the Department of Social Services did sustain financial injury as a result of the misbilling. So that's 3 out of 5, and unfortunately all 5 have to be established, and so I find that the department has not established a claim under Section 523A2A. The second claim is under Section 523A4, pursuant to which a debt for fraud or defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity is non-dischargeable. Under controlling Eighth Circuit authority, and I'm going to quote from State of New York v. Curry, 397 VR 111 122, Bankruptcy District, Minnesota, 2008, the predicate fiduciary relationship requires an express trust established before the action of the debtor that harmed the creditor, or at least the existence of a set of strictly defined legal duties to avoid self-dealing under an objectively manifested, pre-existing, and binding relationship. The existence of this fiduciary relationship is a question of federal law. The requirement is not satisfied by basic facts that would merit the imposition of a constructive trust after an act of wrongdoing under non-bankruptcy law. That case involved Medicaid as well, and the court went through a fairly lengthy analysis of the express trust argument. And the bottom line is, as I was alluding to with my questions to counsel, is that there has to be a race. There has to be something that is subject to the trust. In this case, the paragraph that counsel alluded to clearly provides a contractual obligation for debtor and other providers, in fact, to refund or repay monies that they were not paid appropriately. However, there's no limitation, and that's why I was asking, there's no limitation in the provider agreement on the debtor's use of those funds prior to a demand for repayment. A trust would be subject to limitations, and as Judge Kischel went through in the Curry case, that is in fact dispositive of the question of whether there's a fiduciary relationship, given the fact that, I mean, there's clearly a contractual relationship here, and the contractual relationship is such that were it not for the bankruptcy, debtor would be obligated to repay the overpayment. But under bankruptcy law, there is no fiduciary relationship, and therefore Section 523A4 does not apply. There was also some discussion in the complaint regarding non-dischargeability under some other code sections, 42 U.S.C. Section 1320A-8E1E and 42 CFR 1003.128. Non-dischargeability is a matter of bankruptcy law, not other law. I find nothing in either of those sections that would suggest that they supplement in any fashion Section 523 regarding dischargeable and non-dischargeable claims, and therefore I find that there's been no showing of non-dischargeability under those sections. For all those reasons, I'm going to grant debtor-defendant's motion to dismiss, and I believe that takes care of our involvement this afternoon. Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Chris. More time. CHRIS.